listener production.
Mel's overcorrected and then found herself sliding down the road and unfortunately right into the path of an oncoming four-wheel drive. Yeah, pretty much killed the girls on impact.
You can sense already this is going to be a heavy episode, but a really important one. Hi, everybody. I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
Welcome to another edition of Keep Your Wheels On, the podcast where you'll hear from real people, like today's guest, talking about the mistakes that either resulted in them crashing their car or narrowly avoiding a situation that could have been much worse. And along the way, we're joined by experts to chat about how you can do your best to avoid ending up in a similar situation. Lisa Scaife, distracted driving is one of the key things that you talk about when it comes to driver training, isn't it?
It's one of the Fable Five. And there's all different forms of distracted driving, ranging from mobile phones to eating to kids in the car to, you know, there's so many things that you can be distracted by when you're driving. And it's all about your cognitive load and your focus. You need to just focus on what you're doing when you're driving because there's way too many things that can go wrong very easily.
Our guest today, our expert, is the Managing Director of Driver Safe Australia and the Founder and Chair of the Australian Road Safety Foundation. When he joined us for Season 1, his insights were superb and I have no doubt it will be the same today. Russell White, welcome.
Rusty, Lisa, great to be with you as always, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Why is distracted driving, in your opinion, one of the most frightening things we are confronting at the moment?
Rusty, I think it's a problem because it exists on so many levels. As Lisa mentioned in her intro, the cognitive load and the way that human beings process information isn't necessarily conducive all the time to the task of driving. So when you throw in distraction of that, and there's a range of different levels that it can take form and take shape of, it just elevates the lack of situational awareness that people have. And I think, you know, I've often said, I think distraction for us in the road safety industry, I think distraction is probably the biggest challenge we're going to face going forward, simply because that everybody has a device on them. And not everybody will choose to drink drive, not everybody will choose not to wear a seatbelt, but the majority of people at some point will be distracted by a device. And the unfortunate thing is mobile phones have come on to the scene so quickly in a relatively short period of time. They've gone from being big, bulky brick things that could only make phone calls to now something that's more compact, fits in your pocket, it's on your wrist. And so the capability of the device is far greater. Everybody's got a device on them. So I think for me, distraction is probably the biggest challenge we're going to face going forward, simply because every road user group uses it in some way, shape or form.
As Russell said there, it comes in many forms. It can be mobile devices, something that takes your attention on the road or even the passengers in your car. Now, someone who knows all too well the very real cost of a distraction is Kim. Now, Kim's story might not be his own crash, but it is a crash that has had a devastating effect on him. Let's get back to Kim now.
Hello, my name's Kim. I lost my wife and two daughters in a car crash. My wife, Mel, originally was born in Adelaide, but as a young girl moved to Cooper Pedy, which is a opal mining town here in northern South Australia. So she learned to drive in the country and later on, I guess, a bit like me, transferred those skills to the city where she eventually moved to continue some studies. We were a two-car family. At this point in time, we're living in the Adelaide Hills. I was working in the city, so I would take my car and drive down the freeway into the city. And Mel would take, I guess, the family car with my two daughters and drive maybe 15 k's into a small town called Mount Barker, where the girls went to school and Mel actually worked at the school as well. But certainly on, you know, family holidays or the weekends, we would drive together in the one car. So having kids in the car and driving as a family certainly changes the dynamic a lot. I guess you're not in control of the music. Generally, when you're driving as a family, that sort of privilege gets taken away from you, I guess, but there's a lot more noise in the car. There's a lot more distractions. There's a lot more chatter, conversation. So, you know, I guess when you're driving by yourself, it's very easy to remain focused on the job at hand, where, you know, there's certainly some challenges as a family, you know, especially when you've got small children, and those people with families would certainly understand and appreciate that, with fights in the back seat or children dropping water bottles or wanting food and a whole lot of that. So it certainly does present a different challenge driving with the family.
I've literally been in that area in just the last few weeks for work, so I can picture it quite clearly, Russell. Driving with kids, we tend to, particularly when they're younger, think, well, we'll give them a device because that'll keep them quiet for the road trip, whatever it might be. Can they take the attention away from the driver? Are they a distraction?
It is a challenge. I mean, as a parent, I think anyone who's had kids in the car knows that it's not easy to maintain either a sense of control over what's happening or being able to measure that. But I sort of say to people, you know, the number one job when you're behind the wheel is to drive the car. If you're the captain of the ship, then your focus has to be on that, and it's trying to manage the kids' situation. And I think also educating kids about the risks of distracting the driver when they're in the back seat as well.
I think, you know, it's actually not the kids' devices that are the problem. A lot of the time, it's actually the kids. Monash University did a study back in 2011, and the results were kids were 12 times more distracting than talking on the phone whilst you're driving. I mean, I've had circumstances of exactly this, you know, driving on a freeway and one of my children stuck a fruit bar up their nose and, you know, at 100 Ks, I've got to find somewhere to pull over to extract that same fruit bar. Kids are distracting in the car, but we've actually got to learn as drivers, you've just got to get on with it, and you've got to teach the kids they can't be throwing anything around in the car. They've got to make sure that they know whoever's driving has got to be 100% focused on the driving to get them to that next place safely.
Yeah, and I think, Lisa, you're right. That's where the education comes in as early age as possible. But kids will be kids, obviously, and they will do things like putting stuff up their nose. But I think that the more we can educate kids about that, I mean, you just got to look for strategies that are going to mitigate that risk. And even if something does happen, then you've still got to make the priority of getting off the road as safely as you can and trying to manage that. And I think, again, it's when someone tries to keep driving and try to manage that task, that's where the problems can be. But kids, you know, anybody in the background can be a distraction.
That's a great point you make there about, I mean, fights, tantrums, they happen with younger children, obviously. So, you know, if that's going on and it is taking away your attention, if you are the captain of the ship, as Russell said there a moment ago, pull over safely. Try and diffuse it, sort it out before you get back on the road again. Kids are one thing. A great friend of mine who's a broadcaster is also a very good pilot. And I can remember coming into land with him one night into Sydney in some quite cloudy conditions. And he looked across at me and he said, "Hey, mate, I hope you don't mind. I just really need to concentrate on this." It wasn't a dangerous situation, but he wanted to give it his full attention just because of the added complexity involved. And I reckon having the strength to do that, Russell, just in certain moments, if the conversation, if the music, if whatever is going on from passengers generally is happening, you sort of have to step up and deal with that, don't you?
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, passengers sometimes don't realise, you know, just how easily that you can distract a driver. I can remember, you know, working with a couple of corporate clients, and they'd had an example where a front seat passenger was looking at something on their phone, a video, and then said to the driver, "Oh, check this out." And that ended up in a very serious incident happening. As passengers, we've also got a role to play in that if there is a tricky situation happening, or if the driver is under a little bit of duress in terms of managing a traffic situation, if it's bucketing down with rain, or, you know, if it's some extreme weather event, then chatting to the driver about what we're doing on the weekend is probably not the best thing to be doing.
Can we continue with Kim's story now? And I want to give both our panel and our listeners a little warning here. We have not heard all of this as we record today. Kim's story that we're about to share may be triggering for some people. It does involve a major crash. We are incredibly thankful and grateful to Kim for his bravery in sharing it.
I guess the day before leading up to the crash, we had just returned from a family holiday. We had spent a week on a houseboat with some close friends and had driven back from that holiday in late afternoon. By the time we sort of unpacked the car and unpacked the boat and everyone sort of got settled, it was quite late when we got to bed. I just remember it as being a really fun holiday. I guess the next morning was my first day back at work. So I got up quite early that morning and then quite unusually just left for work without saying goodbye to everyone, just left everyone still asleep because of sort of the late night that everyone had. Drove down to work and sort of went about my day. I rang Mel that morning about 10:30, asked Mel what her plans were. So we had actually brought back a close friend and my eldest daughter as well. She was a family friend. We'd brought her back from the Riverland to stay with us for that next week. The plan was that Mel and the girls were going to go into town. We had some mail to collect and Mel had a few jobs to do in town, so just get some lunch and then drive over to the Barossa Valley to catch up with my sister. My sister had a hairdressing salon in the Barossa Valley, and so the girls were going to get their hair cut before they went back to school and to catch up with their auntie as well. So I guess about 1:40, I get a phone call from my sister asking if I knew where Mel was. At this stage, my sister said that Mel hadn't turned up to the hairdressing appointment, and did I know where she was? So, you know, at this stage, I'm sort of not worried at all. I sort of hung up from my sister and then tried to get hold of Mel on her mobile and couldn't get through, went straight to her message bank, tried a couple of minutes later, still couldn't get through, went to her message bank. And by this stage, you know, I can't really explain it, but I'm starting to get this sort of feeling in my stomach that, okay, something doesn't seem quite right here. I guess over the next 15 minutes, I've maybe tried another 5 or 6 times to get hold of Mel, and each time, yeah, it's just gone straight to her message bank on her mobile. I'm starting to panic here. I decide to jump back into my car, head home, still trying to get Mel on the hands-free. Mel's not picking up. This feeling of anxiety and something not quite being right is getting worse and worse and worse. And I then find myself pulling up in front of the police station and on the way home. Walking in, sort of almost feeling a bit silly, not even really knowing what I'm going to ask, because at this stage Mel simply hadn't turned up to an appointment and wasn't answering her phone. You know, explained the situation to the police. She went out the back, came back about 5 minutes later, said that she couldn't help me, but said there was 2 police officers that were out on patrol who would be back soon and take a seat in the waiting room and we'll get these two police officers to help you when they get back. So I guess with the benefit of hindsight, I came to understand that these 2 police officers were out on patrol actually trying to find our house and were tasked with coming to let me know what had happened. So I just remember sort of their body language, the look on their face. You know, I could sort of see them walking up to the glass door and they came in and pretty much walked straight up to me in the waiting room. And, you know, I think I knew at that stage that something could happen.
Kim, in the description, has taken you to the area in question where this has happened. It's rural by nature. What are the risks when you're driving in a location like that? Roads that are either unsealed or not as good as perhaps what you might get in the city, for example?
Yeah, Rusty, I think, you know, we can already probably tell from Kim's commentary so far just how horrific even just the thought of not knowing what's happening to your loved one can be. And, you know, I think certainly you know, we'll hear more about of the situation as it unfolds. But certainly if you're in places like a rural area, you know, the consequences of a error in judgment or a mistake are going to be far more wide reaching potentially than what we've seen in a metro area. Now, the reasons for that is that typically on a country road, they're just not very as well maintained as a metro road. The edges of the shoulders, the gravel on the side, the trees, rocks, culverts, all that sorts of stuff, spoon drains, you know.
Potholes.
There can be all sorts of things. You're right, Lisa. And the consequence of an overreaction or a mistake or an error in judgment can be far higher. You've also got higher travelling speeds too in most cases. So there's a whole range of things there that can be problematic. If something was to go wrong or something was to change the scenario of what you're doing.
And also on rural roads, a lot of the time you'll actually have a delay in people coming to help you.
Correct.
You know, when's the next person coming to actually see that there's been an accident? How long does it take for emergency services to get to you? All those other things, so which are all contributing factors on rural roads.
If they can't reach you within that sort of hour period, and as you say, Lisa, you know, you can have a situation where the car might not even be visible from the side of the road. So how long are you going to be there? And the longer that period goes for, the chances of survival are much less, obviously.
You can already tell that he can see by the body language of the officers approaching that perhaps something bad is happening here. I mean, it's not just Kim I feel for. I feel for them too with what they've perhaps had to see, to confront.
Imagine having to do that for a job, go and tell people after you've, one, witnessed that, so you're suffering your own trauma, and then you actually have to go and tell the family.
And the consequence of that is they'll do that, and then they'll have to go to a domestic violence case, or they'll go straight to some other thing. And I think it is one of the unsung stories or untold stories with road trauma. The ripple of effect of it can be just so immense, and a lot of the times it's unmeasurable. It might stop people being a police officer or a first responder. Because to be seeing that sort of thing and having to deal with that on a daily basis, and I work with a lot of police, and they just all tell me it's the most horrific part of the job, of either attending that crash or telling somebody, it's just the worst. And I think that's, again, we're getting a sense from Kim's story about the human impact to everybody involved, even if those people involved aren't direct family members. There's still an impact to that, an emotional impact, a psychological impact that's going to have a knock-on effect.
Our producer Todd doesn't let us hear the stories before we record, so we're listening to this just like you for the very first time. So let's get back to Kim and find out what happens next.
I remember everything really clearly. I remember the two of them walking up to me, asking my name, asking me to come and join them in an interview office, asked me to take a seat, asked me to describe the family car that Mel was driving. You know, my heart is beating a million miles an hour. I'm sort of asking what's going on. And it was then they told me that there had been a crash and that there had been a fatality. That point, there's so many emotions running through your body, you know, asking myself who's died, thinking, okay, is it Mel that's passed away, and how do my daughters grow up without a mum? Is it one of the girls that have passed away, and what dynamic does that play? How does Mel go on knowing that, you know, she's been in a crash that's killed one of our own daughters or you know, the little family friend that was staying with us, and we were close friends with her mum and dad, and you know, had to go back and have that conversation with them. And I remember then asking who had died, and and it was then that they said that all four had died in this crash. Yeah, it's a surreal moment. I just remember having this feeling of absolute helplessness. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say, you know, and I just remember having this sort of numbness feeling come over me at the time. They have to arrange for a patrol car to go to Georgie's parents' place to let them know I'm not allowed to ring any family. I'm not allowed to ring Mel's mum, Mel's sister. I'm not allowed to ring Georgie's mum and dad. My sister eventually comes to the police station. Really emotional time. My sister was good friends with Mel, loved my daughters, felt bad because Mel was on a piece of road that she wouldn't have normally travelled on to specifically go and see her. So, you know, she's dealing with all the emotions of that. What we understand to have happened is that Mel and the girls were driving around a sweeping left-hand bend in a 110-kilometre zone, and Mel's got about halfway around the sweeping corner. Her left front wheel of the car has veered off the road into the gravel. Mel's overcorrected and then found herself sliding down the road and unfortunately right into the path of an oncoming four-wheel drive. Yeah, pretty much killed the girls on impact. I guess what evolved out of the investigation the police did after Mel's crash was that they can measure skid marks and, you know, a whole lot of information to try and piece together what had happened. And Mel hadn't been speeding. You know, she certainly hadn't been under the influence of drugs or alcohol, hadn't even been on her phone. But we can assume that she must have been distracted by something. Maybe one of the girls in the back, maybe breaking up a fight, maybe picking up a dropped drink bottle, maybe an animal running across the road. We don't know because we weren't there. You know, it could have been a number of those things. The number of people that's been impacted, like it's so hard to put a number on it. I think about the people driving that four-wheel drive that hit Mel. My heart goes out to them. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, I think about the first person that came on the scene and what they must have seen. All the emergency service people, SES, police, fireys, ambulance people. You know, I think about the two police officers that had to deliver that news to me. You know, I think about Georgie's parents, who what they must have felt when they heard, and the ongoing impact that this has had on their family. My parents, my siblings, Mel's parents, her sister, you know, the girls' sporting club, the girls' school, the girls' teachers, my friends. It's potentially thousands of people that have in some way, shape or form been impacted by this.
Incredibly powerful stuff from Kim. It's hit me a little bit because my eldest daughter is Georgie. That's her name. Imagine being those parents.
You can't help but be hit by that. My God, how on earth do you survive, like manage after that when your whole family that you've created not there anymore?
It's a very poignant reminder of just, again, how quickly all, you know, things can change. And Kim's story, I mean, to lose your entire family, again, I think every single person, regardless whether you're a parent or not, will relate to that. And to have it happen so quickly, when suddenly those lives are just reefed away from you, they're no longer there, it puts a really human context on it. And it's one of the reasons, I think, why, in essence, I started the work we do with the foundation, is because I've heard Kim's story. I've heard stories like Kim's, and sadly we hear them way too often. If you could invent time travel and you could go back and reverse what they're going through, you'd do it in a heartbeat, because the grief is so raw and it's so catastrophic. It's actually hard to put it into words, very difficult in a podcast to try and articulate, you know, what that actually means. And I think you know, it's very difficult to even comprehend what those people go through, and you can't help but put yourself there. How could I possibly go on with life having had that happen? And the people like Kim that do, I think that's an amazing story on its own, to just have the internal fortitude to go, I have to keep going. As I said, it's very hard to describe in words. I think all three of us, you hear that story and you can't help but just become emotionally connected to it. It's awful, awful.
The fact he is prepared to even share it for the benefit of others, I think, shows incredible depth of character. And you know, he sounds perhaps stoic now. I can't imagine what it would have been like in that raw phase, as you said, Russell. It just reinforces. He's arrived at the conclusion that perhaps a distraction of some kind, we don't necessarily know what that is. There was no evidence of mobile phone. Was it kids and perhaps trying to deal with something there? Was it a stray animal running on the road, et cetera, et cetera? But a momentary distraction and the consequences of it, the consequences in this example are so far-reaching.
Rusty, and again, sadly it happens. You know, every day we're hearing this type of thing occurring, and I think it's one of the reasons that, again, it drives the work we do, because you try, and I think everybody in road safety, you're desperately trying to try and turn this around. And I think what's interesting about this particular story, you know, we're hearing that whatever the error of judgment was, a wheel's dipped off the road. Sometimes that happens to people and they correct it, then there's no incident, that's a near miss, and they just go on. In this case with Kim's wife, it ends up with Mel's case, it ends up being something that claims the lives of a number of people. I could list off families that we talk to all the time that have helped us with our campaigns. And again, sadly, it's something that's going to happen to another family maybe in the next couple of hours. Maybe now it's happening, or it's happening tomorrow.
We're normalising it. It's not good. Yeah.
Yeah, 1,250 people die a year. About the same amount of people have lifelong injuries. So they're quadriplegics, paraplegics, brain injuries, whatever else. And then you've got about 50,000 people that are hospitalised per year. But we just sort of, as a community, we've sort of just accepted that that's, you know, that's just the case. We don't accept that in aviation. We don't accept that in, you know, drowning and swimming training or whatever. But we've accepted it as just part of, you drive a car, some people are going to crash and die.
And Lisa, we don't accept it in the military, where people are trying to kill each other, you know, with weapons. And again, I think that's the great thing about sharing stories like this, is that it might wake somebody up to just go, you know, what you do matters. You know, that you can't just treat it as a flippant daily thing you do. It's not like going to make a coffee, you know, it's something that has catastrophic consequences.
I think in this scenario, whether or not it was a distraction and, you know, people in the car or whatever else, or it might have just been literally she's one wheel's gone on a rough shoulder, you know, and she's overcorrected. We still need to be able to train people better for that circumstance in case that ever happens to them, that they might have some muscle memory or some understanding of what to do.
And that's a good point about training and education, because, you know, I find, you know, I was only talking to a group of young people last night. You're given such a rudimentary level of awareness of what this thing can do, I mean, a car. And then sometimes it's not till something like that happens that you realise there's a whole other world that you've never been alerted to, don't know how to correct, don't know how to fix, don't know how to minimise or mitigate. And unfortunately, it's the overcorrection. And it certainly sounds like that in this case, that Mel's done exactly that. A wheel's dipped off. There might have been a panic or a slight overreaction to bring the car back on course, which has been too much. There could have then been a secondary overcorrection because it's now heading on the wrong side of the road. And once that started, and that can all come down to, again, some just being too assertive on the wheel without knowing how not to do that. And then it's led to the car being on the wrong side of the road and having the impact. And again, it all happened so quickly. You know, it's only when people come to us in a post-licence sense that you can then start to experience that. And quite often they come to us after they've had a crash and they just go, I don't know, I was driving along, next minute the car's on its roof. But it's amazing, with just a little bit of information, 20 minutes later they go, oh, I think I understand why that happened now. And probably more importantly, how to stop it from happening.
And that wouldn't have happened if they'd done your training first.
To me, it is dead set wrong that we are not giving young drivers the complete tool set here. It happens in some other countries in Europe. We should be providing them with the kind of training that may just save a life in these sort of sets of circumstances. Russell, are older cars more prone to overcorrecting, or is that something, a myth we need to dispel? It can happen to newer cars too.
There's no doubt the newer cars make it less likely that's going to happen. You know, so if you have got things like electronic stability control and traction control, lane departure, all that sort of stuff is going to help you. I'm not sure the type of car that Mel was driving in this case, but certainly, you know, if you take away those safety aids, there is the chance for the car to become obviously less controllable without that sort of support. You want to be able to have an understanding of driving that even though you've got those things on board, you really hope you never need to use them. So there is no doubt, you know, the modern car, in fact, I've said this so much, I think a lot of the reason why a road fatality rate has come down over the years, it's largely come down to the cars. They've gotten more survivability out of them. Doesn't mean the crashes are happening less, but the survivability rate has increased because the cars, quite frankly, are so good.
I have, over time, been very fortunate to do the kinds of courses that Russell offers, and even with a modern car, you still need to understand what those safety features will do in certain situations so you are aware of it, so you know what the anti-lock braking system, or ABS as we commonly call it, will do in an emergency scenario. Can we come back to Kim, who has been immensely brave, looking at what's happened with his family as something of an opportunity to educate others, to help others, to avoid being in this type of situation. As we come to the point of reflecting at the end of the podcast, let's get some final thoughts from Kim.
There wouldn't be a day that goes by that I don't think about them. There's obviously three birthdays that we celebrate differently. There's Georgie's birthday. There's Mother's Day. There's Father's Day. There's Christmas, Easter, wedding anniversary, anniversaries of the crash, anniversaries of the funeral. There's just so many, I guess, reminders of what, you know, we don't have in our life anymore. I still get extremely sad, but you just learn. You learn to do the best you can. You learn to live with it. I'm not here. I'm not sharing my story for people to feel sorry for me. I just want something positive to come out of this. And if my story gets people to rethink the way they are on the roads, then to me that's something positive to come out of a situation that it's really hard to find anything at all positive from. I know, you know, the girls would approve, if that's the right word. It's a difficult thing to talk about, but if it just gets one person thinking about the risks that we take on the roads, and it saves one family from having to go through what I and other people who knew Mel and the girls, saves someone, another family having to go through all that, then it's certainly worthwhile.
One of the things we haven't really talked about here, he's shown great empathy even for the other car. I mean, we've talked about the loss of his wife, his children, the child that belongs to friends. The fact that he cares about the knock-on effect this has had on the other car, which they were innocent victims in this.
Yeah.
But this is going to have a huge effect on them, and has had a huge effect on them too.
Yeah, 100%, Rusty. I think, you know, you can tell Kim's just been through so much. And I must say, we really have to give him massive kudos.
Correct.
For having the courage to talk about it and to relive it. And he's right. You know, if there's something that can come out of the tragedy of all that, that's, in some cases, that's the only thing that, you know, can keep you going on, is that somehow what you've gone through, if you can somehow prevent somebody else from going through that, then that's probably where the courage comes to share that story. And because he's been through the absolute worst, it's the worst thing you could ever think of. And to have gone through that and to have kept going on, I think it's a great, you know, we need to pay respect to him and acknowledge, you know, the strength that it's had to keep doing that. So the impact of that you know, as he said in the in that piece, it's every day. You'll never get over it. The consequence of something happening there, like I said, it can be catastrophic.
Mel didn't use her phone, but the overarching topic we're talking about here today is the potential for distraction to have massive consequences. Put your phone in the glove box, put it in a bag in the back, or do something through a choice that ensures that you are not going to be tempted by that distraction. For me, I think the big message here is choosing to do an advanced driver training course in our country and across the ditch in New Zealand is a personal choice. It is not something that is mandatory, right? But any kind of training, whether it's the sort of excellent stuff that Lisa's doing in the virtual space so that you are better equipped when you first hit the road, whether it's some of the experiential practical stuff that Russell does on a daily basis, that will be the best money you will spend for the lives of your young ones. You know, there can still be tragic consequences, but it will just give them the skill set, guys, won't it? It will just give them the best chance.
Yeah. We were doing some training last night for a group of new license holders and their parents. And the number of people that came up to me at the end of that course and said, how come no one's told us this before? How come we've never heard what you've said tonight?
It's wrong. It's criminal.
It is criminal.
Because their parents don't know. And their parents are the ones that are doing 90% of the training.
Yeah, you're only ever going to be as good as your coach. And if your coach is only at this level, they'll never get you to here because they don't know themselves. So
yeah.
But it's an amazing the awakening that people have through just some basic things. It's not sort of, you know, rocket science. It's just basic stuff. But it's next level human factors training that suddenly they become aware of. And we spent a little bit of time talking about distraction in the program last night. And I said, and the problem with, and let's take a mobile phone for example, human beings cannot multitask.
Women like to think they can.
Regardless of what anyone thinks, but if they're human, we can't do that. So we process things sequentially and we'll put focus on one thing over something else. And the problem with something like a mobile phone is that it draws you away from being broad and externally focused to being narrow and internally focused. It cuts down your scanning pattern, visual scanning pattern by about 2/3. If you just stay there and say, well, don't use your mobile phone, it's like your parents telling you not to do something. People just go, oh, yeah, I can sort that. I can do that. I can multitask. It's not until you start seeing some science behind it and you start going, so that's why they're saying that. That's when the penny drops.
There's other forms of distraction also that need to be addressed in terms of passengers in cars. If you've got more than two passengers in your car, chances increase exponentially of crashes. Mm. So especially for younger drivers with lack of experience, if you've got, there's a reason why you're only allowed to have one passenger for a certain amount of time. But even, you know, a few years down the track, when you've got more people in the car and they're all screaming and shouting or putting the music on or, you know, whatever else, that is unbelievably distracting. And we need more kids to say, hey guys, I've got to focus here.
It is not something that you can just get into autopilot on, right? You need to have the blinkers of your eyes back. What is that dog on the driveway across there going to do? What is that person coming the other way likely to do? And so on. Think about those sort of things. Be the word we've used in the series so far on a few occasions is awareness. That is so important. I'll give you one final little story here. Greg Murphy, who was with us on the last series, hit the roof recently on a drive in New Zealand. He approached another car ahead of him. There was like a bluish hue inside the car. It was dusk or nighttime. As he went to overtake the car safely, he realized the person was watching a movie.
What?
While they were driving along at 80 to 100 kilometres an hour. Now, they have a great thing in New Zealand, which I think should be incorporated in Australia too, and that is that you can contact police in these moments and make them aware of these matters so that they can go and either speak to that person or perhaps even catch them, right? But he was adamant they were watching television or a movie or something along those lines and was livid.
As you would be.
You cannot possibly have proper control of your car and be making good choices if you have that distraction, right?
I've seen people reading books. I've seen people eating breakfast on the way. And not just something, you know, a proper bowl with something in it. There's research that says if people drive, how they live. And so if you're sort of in this constantly, I'm always late, I'm running, I'll try and do this, I'll try and do six things on the go, that ends up manifesting in the car. And I think in some ways we've dumbed the task, we've perceived, dumbed down the task of driving to a point where people think they can do multiple things at once. And it's just not, it's not true. Like we've spoken about the consequence today of just how one little error, even if you probably were focused on what you're doing, you make one little mistake, the consequence is catastrophic. The chances of that occurring are far, far, far greater if you're doing some other secondary activity that's pulling your attention away from the task of driving.
That's a great way to wrap up this edition. We could go on for a lot longer. Firstly, to Kim, thank you very much for sharing that today. We hope that resonates with our listeners, whether it's mums and dads training their young ones to drive, whether it's those of you that are new to driving. Please listen and listen to it in full. Russell, to you, we wish you continued success on all the initiatives, including what you do so well, mate, around Fatality Free Friday. And keep, please keep the pressure on governments around this stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Rusty. We'll certainly do that.
Thanks, Russell.
On the next episode of Keep Your Wheels On, we've talked trucks previously in this podcast, but with so many of them on the roads, knowing how to drive safely around them is hugely important.
Had I not slowed, she'd have gone straight underneath the fuel tanker that I was driving.
We will hear how that story came to be and meet Matt Wood, the Public Relations and Media Manager at Volvo Group Australia.
If you spoke to any driver, they will tell you how many near misses they've had during the course of a single day.
I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is Keep Your Wheels On. Keep Your Wheels On is a listener production brought to you in partnership with My Drive School. Hosted by me, Greg Rust, and Lisa Scaife. Audio production by Kelly Fulston. And executive producer is Todd Stevens.
A podcast funded by the Australian Government and supported by Repco Authorised Service.
Listener.